Hey, hello guys. We want to welcome you to another live edition of Halftime Chat, and actually I'm enjoying the fact that I'm able to do this as frequently as it is. But this evening, Stevie and I have got a very special guest. He goes by the name of LaFlex, and I think what is interesting about his music, and I remember Stevie sending me his music and to listen, and I was really amazed by the consistency of the sound, and a sound that actually we've moved away from, but actually when you listen to his music and his new album, you'd actually really be bring back not just nostalgia, but a real appreciation for good music. So I want to welcome LaFlex to the show. How you do, sir?
Thank you very much. Thank you for having me. Appreciate you taking the time to have me on.
Yes, I think, you know, I think what is fascinating to me is that, especially I speak to a lot of legacy artists from the 80s and the 90s, and the desire to make new music is limited because financially doesn't seem to pay as much. So it's always fascinating to get artists that are really, you know, really proud about the music they make and really going hard on it. But before we start, because we're going to get an international audience coming through, and there may be those who may not know you, but where are you from? Are you what country are you from? Because LaFlex, I thought you were French.
Yeah, I get that a lot. I get messages in all sorts of foreign languages, as if they assume that I can understand what they're talking about, and I get a lot of French ones. I have to just, like, I speak a little bit of French, but it's mostly like Google Translate. Obviously, I'm from London in the UK, but because I have the le at the front of Flex, it does tend to, the immediate perception is that it's French or something. So, yeah, I get that a lot. My favourites are the sort of Russian and Ukrainian messages I get, just Cyrillic. I have no idea what they're writing. Sometimes it's like walls of text. I'm like, what the hell is that message
about? Yeah. No way. Yeah. Well, AI is getting better, so you'll be able to respond sooner and read them. Mm-hmm. But how did you get into music then, coming up for, in London?
I was into music just as a child because my grandfather was a musician and my father was a musician as well. Wow. And so music was always around the house. My mum played a lot of soul records. And that kind of thing. So I basically just, there was always instruments. And so as a kid, you just sort of smash them about, and, you know, because they make a good noise. And at some point, they must have just said, do you fancy going for lessons? And so I was about seven, so I had lessons. And I just took to it and really enjoyed it. So it eventually became such fun for me. That's all I ever wanted to do. So I couldn't wait to finish school and actually start working in the music business, as it was, or, you know, as a musician. So as long as it was could it be my day job. Yeah, that simple.
Any particular instrument?
Keyboard mainly. I can hack around on the guitar enough, especially nowadays with audio, you can cut and manipulate. I can play enough guitar to be a little bit dangerous. But mostly it's keyboards, yeah.
Who were your early influences as when you were learning your music?
The number one, without a doubt, was ABBA. That was always, wow, whenever we'd be in a family road trip or something, the ABBA cassette would be in the car, and I would know all the ABBA songs inside out. So ABBA was absolutely number one. And then from that, my dad was very much Beatles and guitar-based stuff from the sort of 60s and 70s. And then my mum was the soul stuff, like Luther Vandross and,
wow,
and Lionel Richie. So she would bring all those records in, and my dad would bring all the sort of guitar rock stuff in. So I had a really mixed sort of upbringing of all the just great songs from sort of both sides. So I still listen to the sort of rock type stuff as well. I love all the 80s rock, the Def Leppard and Whitesnake and Bon Jovi, the sort of really pop rock stuff. But my heart's always in the sort of soul side of it, that 80s soul.
So I guess when you get to your teenage years where you're able to now make your own decision as to what you want to listen to and buy, what did you gravitate to?
My first record that I ever bought, I remember taking my money down to what was WH Smith at the time to buy the 7-inch single of Trapped by Colonel Abrams.
Oh, I Like a Fool, I'm So Confused, I Can't Get Out, yeah.
And that bass line. That was the first record I ever bought.
Wow.
And I still have it, actually. It's amazing. So that was the one that sort of got me into that. And then I used to listen to a lot of stuff like Billy Ocean. Really, really, really cool. Yeah.
And when you're listening, are you then also ever thinking about being a musician at that age, or is it just you're doing your music, piano lessons?
No, I was thinking about being a musician at that age. I'll tell you what it was, and I have mentioned this before in my inlay for my vinyl. When I would listen to these songs, especially when you start getting into your teenage years and you start getting a bit of heartbreak or liking somebody and, you know, you're getting a bit shy about it, you would hear these songs. And they would go, that's my situation. That's how I feel. Or,
yeah.
And I, the feelings that listening to these songs gave me, I wanted to do that for other people. Wow. I thought, I want to write songs so that when people listen to my songs, they get the feelings that I'm getting listening to this song. And that was what I wanted to do. That was what I wanted to do, bring that feeling to people. So that's what I've been chasing, basically, all these years.
Yeah. And I guess having your dad as a musician gives you a sense of, it's almost like you can touch it, because if, you know, if you didn't come out for the house or where somebody actually plays, it might seem like a harder vision. How did your dad support you outside of just the lessons?
Well, my mum and dad I basically begged them to buy me my first synthesizer. And it's one of those things that's a huge expense at the time, you know, synthesizers.
Back then.
Back then, not that they're not now, but it's lots of plugins and stuff now. But to buy a synthesizer back then was a big deal. And for me to say that it's not just going to be a toy and I'll get 5 minutes and I'll throw it away type thing.
Yeah.
So they really believed that I wanted to do that and supported me, and then obviously helped lessons and stuff like that. And just generally encouraged me. I mean, when I was sort of 16 or so, I joined like a band, just some friends and stuff, and you know, they supported me, driving me around, dropping me off, being roadies, and you know, just giving me pocket money and letting me not get a real job. It's like, you can go and get your musical dream, we believe in you. So that was amazing. I can never thank them enough for that.
Yeah, so we're getting into your formative years of, you know, late teens into your early 20s. How close are you to becoming the musician that you were chasing back then?
Well, I started writing songs around then. I started writing songs probably about 14 or so, just terrible things. You know, didn't really know how to write a song. And then I joined the band. We wrote a few songs again, absolutely terrible. And then at the tail end of the 80s, the absolute number one place in Britain for pop music was Stockaken and Waterman.
They did the Kylie and
Kylie Jason, Rick Astley and all that stuff. And so I just thought, that is the place that's just having the success, fantastic song, pop songs and stuff. So I basically at the tail end of sort of what they were doing, went to their studio and got a job sweeping the floors and making tea and stuff.
Wow.
And basically just around that kind of studio environment and meeting people, and then because I could play, I was suddenly thrust into, oh, we need someone to play a quick bass line, there's no one around, can you do it? And I was like, okay, duh, 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 duh. And then you make yourself useful, and eventually you're making records. So I had like a serious few years of hard, intense lessons of how to actually make a record and to write a song. So it was an incredible time.
You at that early age, you're meeting the most formidable pop writing and producing duo in the UK. What was that like, actually? Because you just made it seem as if you were just in the studio. Seeing them in the flesh and then actually seeing them.
It was. I mean, it was just day in, day out. There was just records being made, and it was a kind of blink and you miss it. You had to really pay attention. That time was money, and you know, the studios were running 24 hours a day, and you had to learn fast. And it was I can look back at it now and go, oh, I remember this, I remember that, and I met this person and I met that person. But at the time, it was just put your head down and just work as fast as you can and do as much as you can. And you didn't realize how much you were learning until you actually then come to do something else. And that, remember, but those days were still tape machines and things like that. There was no audio like there is nowadays. You couldn't chuck things in Pro Tools and edit it and stuff. Everything was done to a tape. And I had to learn how to cut tape and edit together to do edits singles and things like that. And, you know, run it. There's like a, nowadays, if I finish a song, I can just send someone an MP3. But back then, there was a guy on a bike, a courier outside on a bike, waiting for you to get a cassette theme. Hold on, we're just running the mix off. Run a cassette, give it to the bike, and he would drive it across London at midnight for someone to check the mix. It was just, you know, crazy. But now you just do a click of a button. It's ridiculous.
But was it fun, though? I mean, when you look back in those, I mean, it sounds like it was very little pay, lots of hard work, but was it, could you enjoy it?
it was the best time of my life. Literally, it was amazing. Yeah, it was just, I was sleeping at the studio most of the time because, of course, you're underpaid and they want you there.
Yeah.
There's always something you can be doing. So, I was just spending more time there, sleeping there, and just, but it was, you know, I was young and fit, and that's all I wanted to do. It was like, I would have paid them. let
me work. But, well, the idea then to be like Waterman and being a producer, or did you still chase to want to be your own singer-songwriter?
It was basically to write songs. For the whole thing, for example, Le Flex, I see myself as the songwriter. I only produce the songs because I don't think anyone else can do it as I want it. So I produce them and I sing them because I couldn't find a singer. When I first started doing Le Flex, I was going to find a singer to do it, and it was becoming a pain. I thought, I'll just try it myself and see what it sounds like. And so when I opened my mouth, that's the sound that came out. And I was like, okay, I can kind of live with that. And so I became the singer and producer, but I only really want to be the songwriter. That's what I enjoy doing.
Was it like a David Guetta, like, okay, I'll do the song and you just get a guest vocalist? Was that the initial thought being a...
That was the initial thought, yeah. But then people want to change things. Oh, well, I think it should go like this, or they don't quite sound it right. And in the end, I think I'll just try and do it myself. And if it sounds okay and I can get away with it, then that would be great. So I did that and then it worked out okay.
Wow.
I didn't sound too bad.
Yeah, I mean, I'll get to your vocals. I mean, okay, I might as well ask now, because I have in my mind who, when you sing, the person that it reminds me of. But who do you think people have said that you sound like when they listen to your records?
Well, I know who I try to sound like, and because I try to sound like a mix between Babyface and Julio Iglesias.
Okay.
Because I love the way Babyface is not a fantastic singer. He's a fantastic songwriter.
Yeah.
He writes songs for fantastic singers like Boys to Men, for example. But his own stuff, he's not the best singer, but he does amazing with what he has. So that was like thinking, I thought to myself, I'm not a great singer, but I can really work. I know how to work with what I've got. So I kind of model what I did on him. And then I just love Julio Iglesias and the way he expresses and what he does. And so I try to, when I'm singing, I'm trying to be either Babyface or Julio Iglesias in my mind.
Yeah.
But every other comment on my YouTube channel and this, that, and the other is, oh my God, it sounds like George Michael.
Well, I'm not the only one there, because that's what I listen to.
I mean, George Michael is actually my favorite male singer. So yeah. I will take that. But for me, it's just like I can't even begin to let myself be compared to George Michael. He was an incredible singer, the amazing singer. That's not me at all. I have maybe my tone is of that, but that's just the tone I have. That's not me trying to sound like that. That's just my voice. But yeah, I'm wishing I was Babyface and Julio mashed together. Maybe if you mash Babyface and Julio, it sounds like George Michael.
It probably does, but it does. I mean, I was listening. I'm saying, wow, this is because I don't think. George Michael gets the recognition and credit he deserves as a songwriter, as a singer. I think a lot of people, you know, sort of the Adonis of a man, they forget he wrote and produced pretty much 90% of his own, all his stuff. And vocally, especially his latter stuff, really, really showed a vulnerability in his vocals. Yeah. And that's what sometimes, especially in some of your ballads, it really comes through, that type of vulnerability in the ballad. So that's when I was thinking, oh, that's like George Michael.
Yeah, it is. I try to get that feeling into the lyrics. When I have a lyric that's saying something like that, I try to put the emotion into it and try to make it sound as if it's actually being felt as opposed to just singing it. So I think a lot of that comes through. But I'm just, you know, I had no idea until the comments started coming in. I just opened my mouth and this is the sound that came out. And I was like, okay, I'll take that. I don't agree because I can't bring myself to agree because I hold George Michael in such esteem.
Yeah.
You know, all I can say is there's a lot worse people to be compared to.
Yeah, definitely. But I think the style of the sound that you've really built upon. When did you decide to go in this direction? Because I know you said yes as a kid you listened to ABBA, but then you've talked about Babyface and I would assume some R&B and hit and New Jack Swing in the 90s. I mean, all so how did you decide?
Well, because I basically put my flag down on the side of the R&B and the soul. I just thought there's something about those songs that, you know, is just everything. And the whole reason for starting LaFlex was that no one was making that anymore, as far as I could tell. Those songs that I loved when I was a kid growing up, the ones, you know, that I would go, like the Colonel Abrams, I would go out and buy, and the ones that my mum would play, you know, the Luther stuff and the Lionel Richie and all that kind of thing, the Babyface, etc. I couldn't find it anymore. It was still, those songs were still around, but I couldn't find any new music like that. And I thought, I'm going to make my own, essentially. So that's just what I decided to do. And that's why I stayed with that sound and why I continue with that sound, because I'm still chasing, to this day, chasing that particular sound, because I just can't get enough of it. I just love it. And every time I come up with something good, I'm like, thank you. That's another one that I, you know.
Because I know you've got an amazing and faithful following of people who really appreciate you and your music. Did you decide to do this sound for yourself, or did you think there should be a big market for this? Let me go in this direction. What came first?
It's 100% for myself. I just write for myself. I don't ever think, what would the audience like? I just write for myself. And if someone else likes it, then that's fantastic. But I think the second you start trying to please an audience, you're dead, basically, because some people will like it, some people won't. You're always going to have people that won't like it. So I never, ever think, I wonder if the fans will like this one or will they not like this one. I can sometimes tell. I think, oh, this one would be popular, perhaps. and other times I've thought something would be popular and it wasn't remotely popular. I've thrown songs away that people have turned out to be their most favourite as well.
Wow. So,
but everything I do is just, I want to do it because it pleases me. It's what I want to hear. And if anyone likes it, that's an absolute bonus, but I don't chase that.
The industry itself has transformed since the days of when you were not just the recording and producing elements of it, but also the way we as consumers consume music. And then back in the day, you spoke about buying your first Colonel Abraham single. So you actually bought it, you put it in a tape or CD player, you read the liner notes and everything. Yeah. So we appreciated music so much more. And now we've got it streaming and Spotify and YouTube. So there is, I don't know if I appreciate music the same way when it doesn't seem like it's an experience going to the shop and buying it. More so for yourself as a musician, as a singer, songwriter, financially, it doesn't seem as safe because a CD sold, you knew how much it costs and how much you get. There's a different landscape now. How then do you balance making music that you enjoy doing, but also financially making sure that it's profitable?
Well, the problem I think nowadays is music is totally disposable now. It used to, as you say, mean something. You used to save up to go and buy the album and you would sit there listening to it and reading the liner notes. I know I did. And you can't even get liner notes nowadays.
Yeah.
I used to know all the musicians on all the records I listened to. You know, you look at the back of Thriller and you'd be like, this is the bass player, this is the keyboard player. And then you would say, you know, Greg Fillinganes on keyboards, and then you would spot him on about 20 other records. These musicians were really famous, you know, like even the members of Toto that were famous session musicians as well. And nowadays you haven't got a clue who's playing on anything.
Or recording studios or engineers.
Or recording studios or anything. You know, there were clever places that you would love to visit. You know, you'd see the names of these studios and stuff, and it actually meant something when someone had an album out. And now it's like been and gone. It's before you blink, there's another track on, or and this piece, and you used to have to have a bit of ceremony taking the record out of the sleeve, putting it on the needle on, or doing the tape, or doing the CD. Now it's just a click, and next on click, next on click. It's just like there's no love for it anymore. I mean, the financial differences are, I mean, it can be two things, because it's cheaper to make records now. I mean, you used to have to spend millions for the big records that were made. You know, you would have to be in a major recording studio with a huge desk and spend months in there, and it would be millions and millions of pounds for different things on budgets, or thousands of that on budgets. But nowadays, it's like it's a laptop and a copy of Logic, and that's your studio. So the cost of making records is down hugely. But then so are the royalties. So, you know, the absolute heyday of CDs when, you know, Dire Straits was absolutely the money. Was it the Money for Nothing album, whatever it was, the Brothers in Arms album, was just like selling like hotcakes, of the absolute gold being printed. When it was physical media. But nowadays, it's practically disposable, and there's new stuff coming along every single day. You know, it's not what it used to be. The love is I miss that about music.
But then, as an independent artist, then how does it work for you then? I mean, as I said, how do you manage? You know, I know you're putting out the music, but then you still want people to buy and actually make it where you're not ducky. You've put out the music, now you're gonna go work your 9 to 5, then come back on the weekend and sing.
Yeah, well, fortunately, because of what I've done over the years, I've managed to work in music and not have any other 9 to 5s or side things, because I still do other things within music. Obviously, Reflex is my main thing, excuse me. But I still have other music projects that I work on for TV and film and stuff like that, which I get paid for as well. So I manage to still stay within the realm of music. I don't have to go and get like an office job or anything like that on the side. So I'm quite fortunate in that respect. But that's because I've been doing it for so long and have a network of people that I work with. But yeah, for people that sort of starting out trying to do it, it's difficult to make money at it. And plus, nowadays, you've got to wade through the absolute loads of absolute rubbish on TikTok and all this sort of stuff. Everyone's got a copy of GarageBand nowadays, and they're putting out songs and calling themselves a producer, just dragging and dropping loops around. And it used to be you have to really want it. And, you know, back in the days, you would have to get money together to go and hire a studio and be able to actually play an instrument. But now it's just drag and drop some loops. Oh, look, I've made a record, I'm going to put it on TikTok. So the barrier to entry is really low. So we've just got this deluge of absolute rubbish, and it's about who can shout the loudest rather than who's got the best music, essentially, you know.
So how have you managed to cultivate a very faithful, because we're going to talk about your new video that has just come out, which is fan made, which is awesome. So, but how, what did you do differently to really make sure you got an audience of people who can appreciate what you're doing and really stay connected with them?
I don't actually know, to be honest. Okay. I literally made my first sort of Reflex couple of songs, and I put them up on the internet. I think it was SoundCloud at the time, which was quite popular. And just luckily, people found them and started sharing it. I didn't have a plan or anything, because I didn't actually think anything was happening. I was literally making the music for myself as a release. I was like, I need to make something that I love, because I was working on lots of projects, paying projects, you know, for money and stuff, but it wasn't any kind of art or pleasure to it. It was very much cookie cutter, you know, rubbish, banal stuff. So I thought, I'm going to start hating music. If I don't do something soon that I like, I'm gonna start hating music, and I will fall out of love with it. And I really didn't want to do that, so I basically started Reflex as a reaction to that, and just thought, as long as I can be making a little something on the side that I'm enjoying, finding the love for, then it's going to be okay. And so I started Reflex and just started chucking it on the internet, and it just found its own audience, fortunately. And Reflex ended up being the name. It was only a temporary placeholder name. I just thought, I'll use that, because I couldn't think of anything better. And then people started finding it and sharing it, and I was like, oh shit, I can't change it now. I didn't expect anyone to even find it. I ended up stuck with Reflex, but it's been great actually. It's worked out okay. So.
What about performance then? Do you then now say, okay, let me take this onto the road, because you do have a following and stuff.
Yeah, I mean, I'm fortunate. I have audience from so many different countries. I mean, I do live streams. Yeah. You see them all checking in. I'm here. I am in one side of the world, and then someone else from the other side of the world. It's absolutely incredible to me. I would like to do that. It's a bit of a logistical nightmare. I've done a couple of things, but it tends to be me just ferrying a load of stuff around on my own and trying to get it all to work. So once I've got the band together, as it were, then it'll be a lot easier. So yeah, I would like to do that. I would enjoy that, I think. There's so many countries I'd like to visit and do that as well.
Yeah, I mean, Stevie, I mean, as I said, you've been a big fan for a long time.
Yeah, you know, it's like I've been championing this guy on my radio show for the last few years. I think you kind of answered a question earlier about the music that you're making, how you wanted it to feel and how you felt making it. It's like when I've been doing my radio show, I'm playing stuff to keep relevant, you know, finding a certain age, you know, looking at the young R&B that's coming out now. And then I'm also looking for records that give me a certain feeling that I got, say, from when I was a teenager coming up through the late 80s and getting that amazing feeling of, you know, hearing Misha Paris for the first time. And
Glenn, that first Misha Paris album, oh, my God.
you know, Johnny H. Jazz.
Yeah, all of those.
You know, all that stuff that was coming out. And I'm juggling this and suddenly... I've come across Reflex twice. The first time I didn't know about, because it was under a different name, and it was the late 90s. I was buying records in an underground soul music record shop, and this white label appears. I think it was East Side Connection or something. Let me look at you tonight. And then you covered that record, but I didn't know that was you'd actually...
My own song, yeah.
You've done it, you know, you've done that record twice. Yeah. So I remember seeing that white label basically fly out the record shop, and he didn't even have his name on it.
Wow.
It turned up on a Jazz FM compilation as well. It's been played on London Radio, Underground Soul Radio. And then a few years ago, I think I was just going through YouTube, and I was always looking for music with a groove, and I just stumbled across Reflex, found this album where he looks like Miami Vice, but he did look fresh, but he's in his Miami Vice suit. And there's a couple of tracks on there. There's a track called Gentleman, which was a dead ringer should have been recorded by Alexander O'Neill, but
yes,
you know, Reflex, you know, in fact, Reflex should have gave that song to Alexander O'Neill.
I would have done if I could have got it to him.
But yeah, and then I was like, then I realized you've got this whole back catalogue of stuff. But I was scratching my head thinking, how is this guy not being played in soul and R&B circles? And I personally wanted to change that. That was my kind of mission. It was like I started playing your music, but also telling other soul and R&B DJs that I knew, have you heard of this guy called Reflex? And people are going, I don't know. I said, well, check this out. So that's been my kind of mission, really, because I think that, you know, that audience would love your music, and they haven't been hearing it. And I'm thinking, why, you know?
Yeah, I mean, I've got to say straight away, Stevie, thank you for all your support, because you've been, as I say, more than a couple of years now, you've been playing my stuff and always championing it and, you know, on your social media and stuff. So thank you very much for that. I really do appreciate it. But yeah, I'm glad you said that, because as you said, it's like, the music that you were always looking for, but they don't make anymore. And that's exactly what I was trying to do. I mean, there's a couple of tracks I know that you've played on your show where I'm sort of going for the what's it called? The Jam and Lewis vibe for the... Oh, I've forgotten the name of the act now. The Just Be Good To Me guys.
Oh, SOS Band.
That's it, guys. SOS Band. Yeah, the SOS Band type of groove. Love, love, love all that kind of stuff. So I'd love to get the 808 drums out and all the fat bass lines and, you know, do all that kind of thing.
Do you look back to that era? I look back to that era now, and I almost feel like it's like the land that time forgot almost. And I think I look back and I think, did it actually happen? Because things have changed. And maybe because of my age, but it's changed so much. Top of the Pops has gone. You know, record shops are, they're like boutique shops now.
Yeah.
It was everything back then. And it's like you were saying earlier, it's all just dissipated, hasn't it, really?
Yeah. The value has gone from music. Because you used to really love... songs were really well written and well crafted by songwriters. And nowadays, you go to the song that's in the top 10 and you look at the credits, and it's got like 10 writers on it. how has it taken 10 people to write this dirge? And it boggles my mind. Yeah. And it's just shoved in your face. This stuff is just shoved in your face by radio and Spotify playlists. And there's not a lot of song craft, it seems, at the moment. It's just like a load of writers getting in the room. What can we get that's going to be popular on TikTok? Let's get some this happening, that happening. I really miss those days of the huge songwriters, the famous songwriters, like the Diane Warrens and the Babyfaces and the Teddy Rileys and the Jam and Lewis. You would look forward to a new release if you knew a certain songwriter. I remember when that Michael Jackson's nephews, is it 3T they were called?
Yes, they had Y.
Their album came out, and I looked at the inlay sleeve in HMV, and it had a song on it by Babyface, and I bought it just because it had a Babyface song on it, and it was one of his best songs. It was a song called Why.
Yeah, Why.
And that's the sort of thing I would do. I would listen to a Diane Warren. If Diane Warren's written a song on that, I'll buy that just because of this song, particular songwriter. And you really don't have those sort of people anymore, those songwriters that you would go, the Rod Tempertons, et cetera. You're just like, it's just gone. it's a bit songwriting by committee nowadays.
Yeah, I mean, you're right that, as I said, I'm a massive Teddy fan. And if I knew he was on a track back in the late 80s, he would have... Bernard Bell writing for him, or Tammy Lucas.
Yeah.
And then you could sort of feel the vibe, or when you have LA and Babyface with Daryl Simmons, and you sort of know the structure, the harmonies and what to expect, or Jam and Lewis when they're doing their writing and songs. And I remember interviewing Soul Shock from Show Shock and Colin, and he was saying that Jam told him, look, man, don't chase the hits. Just focus on the song. If it becomes a hit, that's great, but just focus on the song. But as you say now, the idea is we need to get a viral song. And there's a generation of people that just want that quickly, microwave it, and it goes, and then nothing lasts.
Sorry to interrupt. I was going to say, those songs that we're listening to nowadays, these songs that are in the charts nowadays, you won't be hearing them on Gold or Smooth Radio in 30 years, the way we still listen to Earth, Wind and Fire, for example, nowadays. All these classic songs come on the radio, they will still be getting played in 30 years, but the stuff that's out nowadays won't be getting played in 30 years' time. It's just generic. It's just rubbish.
Yeah.
Occasionally you get a diamond, occasionally will pop up, and you go, someone's done something really good. You can sort of a chorus that you can hang your hat on, maybe, but a lot of time it's just, we need to go viral, and once it's gone viral, forget about it. We need another song that goes viral, and he has to make a stupid dance for it or do something.
But with yourself then, what do you do when you are, do you come up with the lyrics first, or are you playing the melody and then you write to it, or what comes first for yourself?
I generally come up with melodies and chords first, and then the lyric afterwards. I have occasionally come up with titles first, or a good lyric, and I'll try to sort of come up with something. And by the way, guys that are watching, I can see your comments in the stream, so thank you very much for your comments. I am reading them, but obviously answering.
Yeah.
It was, for example, Stevie was championing a little bit of song off my new album, which is again in the SOS band style, a song called Angela. And I was sitting at the piano, and it was like a that sort of that movement type thing. And I just happened recently at that time, I wanted to write a song with a woman's name. Because I love Angelia by Richard Marx. I love Toto's got Rosanna and Pamela. Elton John's got Nikita. There's Sarah by Starship. There's all these great songs that I loved. Had a song about a girl, a particular name. I was like, I want to write a song with a title of a girl's name. And so it was that. Just Angela was the one that came in and fitted. I was like, that's it. And then I get loads of messages now. Who is Angela? Is this a real person? Maybe it is. I'd like to meet her one day. So that kind of thing happens like that. It was just I had the intent to use a name, and then I had the melody, and it just kind of fits together. It happened. And other times I can write things very fast. Like I have a song called "One You Want," which was literally a few hours. That was done start to finish. And then other songs are years. I will come up with something and then get stuck, and then I think I'll move on to something else. And then I'll come back to it 6 months later and maybe add a little bit, and then a couple of years later add a little bit, and find old dictaphone tapes with melodies on, and then I'll take that and add it and make a bit of a sort of Frankenstein's monster of it all. It sounds cohesive at the end, but you know, it can be a little bit sort of thrown together.
On this new album though, as well as the romance and the love, I've noticed there's a bit of a very suggestive tone to it. It's a very, let me just put it out there, a bit of Great British naughtiness.
Exactly. Yeah. I wanted to.
The album
wanted to
cover, view the song titles.
Exactly. Well, you know what? We used to be able to do that stuff regularly. Totally. Prince was at that sort of stuff all the time. And we've kind of lost that. People are afraid of getting shouted down or cancelled or all of this kind of stuff, and everything's got to be really safe. And I'm like, no, I don't think so at all. I really miss that. And it's not even particularly risky or risque even. It's
done tastefully, but you can tell.
It's nothing
which I like. It's all very suggestive.
Yeah. You know? I mean, I remember when George Michael came out with "I Want Your Sex" and the world lost its mind. And it's just like, no, it was fine. There was nothing wrong with it. It was just, and he didn't write it to shock. It was just what he wrote. And it just happened, you know, such that nerve. And the best thing ever was that they banned it. Like they banned Frankie Goes to Hollywood Relax. And as soon as they ban it, it's like, phew, off it goes. And so there's always going to be sort of naysayers. But it was definitely my intention to speak to the heart a little bit and then maybe speak to the underpants a little bit.
I mean, my favorite track is "Behind Closed Doors," and I think because we don't hear a saxophone that much in a record, and I just love the nostalgia of getting that saxophone played in there.
I know. I remember in the 80s and some of the 90s, all songs would have a guitar solo or a sax solo.
A sax solo.
I used to love the guitar solos and the sax solos. I'd be there with my tennis racket in front of the mirror giving. And it was just, we don't have that anymore. I was like, I'm putting saxophone solos everywhere I can. And it's just a beautiful, sexy instrument, and it sounds amazing. Slap a big reverb on it, and it's incredible. So I absolutely love that kind of stuff. And I think it's really emotive. You know, when you get a nice guitar solo or saxophone solo, you really do get a good emotion from it as well, a good feeling. So I definitely...
Thoughts of You as well had a little bit of it, because the thing with Careless Whispers, one of our most popular songs, had the whole saxophone in and out, and so I'm listening to that and the nostalgia is in there. Are you playing them yourself, or are you getting a saxophone musician?
I don't play saxophone. I have a couple of guys that I use. I a lot of the time I write the lines. Some of the solos, I write them on I play like a little crappy sample saxophone on the keyboard, and I send it to them and say, can you kind of do that, but better? And they always just smash it. And then other times I say, well, look, if you can do that bit exactly how I want it, and then you can just do what you want afterwards, which is these sorts of You happened. I said, can you play this solo? And then on the outro, play what you want. And the guy just played the most amazing stuff, so much so that I included his complete unfiltered solo on the end on the new album. He's the last track is a bonus track of him just doing that So yeah, I love doing that. I'm too lazy to learn the saxophone at this point. Although I would like to.
But when I spoke to Jimmy Jam about when he did Scream and there's that guitar solo part, and I thought, oh, did he get? And I said, did you get Prince to do it? He says no, that he used his keyboards to play it. So when I thought that, when I heard a sax on, say, Behind Closed Doors, I thought you were playing the sax on your keyboards and then it just, you know, converts it, but it doesn't work that way.
It doesn't. I don't think the technology, I mean, it is amazing. It's not quite there to completely fool people yet.
Okay.
I think when you get someone properly on the instrument, it always is up another level. There's been a number of, you know, I use a lot of sometimes guitar plugins. Sometimes I play real guitar and sometimes I play sort of MIDI guitar, depending how prominent it's going to be in the mix and what I'm going to use it for. So you can get away with it to a certain extent. But yeah, it is nice when you get an actual properly skilled musician who understands what you're trying to do. So I love it.
Marcelo says he thought Behind Closed Doors was a reference to William Pitt, City Lights. I don't know what that...
I don't know what that is, actually.
Okay.
I will look
okay.
Yeah, and it's funny that I've got a lot on Behind Closed Doors. Everyone's talking about the verse being very Pet Shop Boys because I'm speaking the verse. And that was me just being lazy. I was thinking, oh, I need to write a verse melody now. I'm thinking, oh, God. And I wanted to get this song. It was like one of the last songs to be done on the album. Like, I've got to come up with a verse melody. And then I just started, as I was playing it round and round and round, trying to think of a melody, I just started, just started mumbling the words. I was like, actually, I might be able to get away with that. And it was like, because Neil Tennant from the Pet Shop Boys talks a lot of the verses for Pet Shop Boys. So, yeah, that was great. And a lot of people picked up on that, which I was really pleased about.
Yeah, I got a friend out in Switzerland, DJ Soulchild, saying that his proper geese are very likable and relatable dude. But I see that a lot of your fans and your community do seem to feel that you are relatable. It just seems, especially your little videos about, okay, see how I started it, you know, how you're doing your production or something behind the scenes. Is that something that you had to learn to become relatable to your fans? Because you said...
A little bit, yeah. I did, my very first behind the scenes video was for a song I wrote called Alone Together of my first album. And if you watch the behind the scenes video, I don't actually speak. I just play it and then look at the camera and then change the instrument and play and just keep looking at the camera. Because I was thinking... I wasn't quite comfortable. Not that I wasn't comfortable, but it just felt weird to me. But I always love, for example, these records in the 80s that I grew up listening to. You always listen to them. I would in my mind, because of what I wanted to do as a musician, I was like, how did they do that? How was that made? I had no idea. And nowadays, fortunately, some of these older musicians are getting interviewed on YouTube and getting asked these questions. They say, no, it was just this guitar and this plugin or this pedal, and or we did this and we came up with this. And you can now find all this stuff out. But back then it was a mystery. And so I like to sort of sometimes speak about how I'm making stuff because some people are interested. And so it's just nice. And again, it gives you content. As much as I loathe the sort of way things are done social media wise nowadays, it's nice to have actual content to share with people. And they see the person behind the music that they're listening to. So, you know, I used to get questions about, oh, what drums do you use or what's this and what's that? So I generally try to put things on there so they can sort of see what I'm doing. And it's a bit of fun, basically. Yeah. So, but it's nice. And I get the interaction from speaking to fans as well. I get amazing messages all the time, which I really do appreciate.
I mean, speaking of fans, I mean, you've got Isabella from Spain. You've got Chris Hopp from, she's in Mexico. So you're getting fans from all over the world, which is amazing. You just put out a fan video, and I think this is the second one you've done.
Third one.
So how did it all start and what happened? That must be massive editing. And, you know, how many videos are coming in and how long does that take?
It takes a while. The first one I did was only a couple of years into the Flex, and I had the idea to do it, but I didn't think I had enough fans to fill it. I was thinking for ages, if I put out the call to ask people to send me in videos if I make a big thing about it, and everyone's going, "Oh, I can't wait to see this," but I only get like 3 videos. It's gonna. Sorry, it's not coming out. I didn't get enough videos. I'm not as popular as I was hoping. But luckily, I got enough, just enough to scrape through on the first one, and then the second one I had excess, and this current one I had excess. So I didn't get to include everybody. So apologies for people that didn't get included. But I just like to include people, and it gives me, you know, it's a great to have another video, because I appear in my videos, but it's a real pain in the ass, to be honest, to make videos. You know, the number of times I've been editing a video and thinking to myself, this is absolutely the last video I'm going to make, because that's a nightmare. But the fan stuff is good. The weird thing is, because people have various phones, some people film portrait, and some people film landscape, and then some people have sound, and some people don't. Not obviously, I don't use any of their sound anyway, but and some people are filming on like a really good phone, and some people are filming on what looks like a potato or something. Ridiculous. And so I try to think, can I include that? Does it look too bad? Or and then I'm trying to find. Some people all send in a chorus. I'm thinking, I've got nobody singing the second verse here. I hope somebody sends in the second verse, because I've got no second verse. Everyone's singing the chorus. I can't put everybody in the chorus. And so it gets a little bit at the end. Am I going to have that line? Or am I going to have that line? But generally, it works its way out. So it's good, and I have fun with it, and you can see the people that take part, they have great fun. They do some really crazy things, and some dress up, and some do. One guy dressed up as me for the last video. He copied my outfit from one of my videos and was playing the piano.
I did think it was you for a second.
Yeah.
But
you have some bizarre things going on in your videos, though. I've noticed the videos you've done in the past, I feel like you've been watching some bad VHS 80s movie or something. You get some bizarre costume that appears out of nowhere, you know.
I do that. I love, especially like you say, the Miami Vice thing. You know, I was rewatching all the Miami Vices a few years ago, and I was like, right, I got to get the Crockett gear on, and I need to find that. I want to do that. And it's just me being what I wanted to be when I was young. It's like I can get to play all those fantasies out now, you know, watching that stuff and putting a guitar and getting the smoke machine out and all that kind of thing. It's just me doing what I wanted to do when
I was that 80s movie where it's a bunch of teenagers and they create their fantasy dream woman.
I watched that Weird Science. I literally Weird watched Science. It.
You stole something from that. I'm sure you stole something from that.
I steal stuff from everywhere. Yeah, I steal stuff from everywhere. Every time, I mean, I love going back and watching the 80s films and the 80s music, and I'm always keeping notes of things that I hear or things that I see and go, I'll try and use that, constantly, all the time. I've got like a little notebook. And when you can't think of any ideas, you just go and sift through your little notes you made. And
have you been listening to, I'm listening to this album, hearing a lot of Imagination on it. Just things.
Yes, I love Imagination.
From the 80s, you know?
Yes, I absolutely love Imagination. It was one of those, Imagination was one of those bands when I would be in the car as a kid and you would hope that it would come on. I remember driving back from somewhere with my parents and I hope that Just an Illusion song comes on. I hope it comes on. And then it came on at some point. I was like, oh my God, just love it. And you never quite know what, as a kid, you don't quite know what it is. You get these evergreen songs. I remember, and you don't know what they are. I remember being young and a constant rotation, you know, on classic radio and still to this day is I'm Not In Love by 10cc with all the voices, the choir. And every time that would come on, I'd be like, what the hell is that? That's the most beautiful thing I've ever heard. But you don't know what it is. Unless the DJ says this is whatever, you don't know. And you have to wait for it to come on again and hope that you're with someone you can ask, what is this? And I remember that distinctly. Clouds Across the Moon is by the Ra Band, a song that I covered. I remember being in someone's kitchen and that came on the radio and absolutely falling in love with it. And then at the end, they said what it was. And I wrote it down on a piece of paper so that I wouldn't forget it. And to this day, when I got the chance to record it myself. And fortunately, the Richard Anthony Hewson, R.A.H., the actual Ra Band guy that wrote all the songs and did all the Ra Band stuff, emailed me. He got my email and he sent me an email saying, lovely email saying, love your cover of my song. You've kept all the chords correctly. You've really done it with love. And I really love, that was like amazing. So stuff like that is absolutely fantastic. Yeah.
I'll tell you something that I have noticed, and this is more on a positive note, because I'm always looking to introduce like new sounds and play new sounds. It's harder because everything has been done, and I'm not saying this has not been done before, but you know, this 80s boogie sound that has been here forever, and also synth pop. I think there is emergence at the moment, and it's coming back. I've noticed there's a young market for it. There's boutique labels still making it. There's a little scene in LA that I've noticed that are doing like this boogie synth pop sound. Mm. And I think there is. I think what you're doing now, if you just hang in there a bit longer, I think you'll see this sound come back again. Not like take over, but not cross over again. But I feel that people want it. You remember it, people want it to come back, you know.
Yeah, it is. It does seem that way. I am seeing a lot of it, thankfully. The problem that for that stuff, but obviously you being at the sort of roots level at radio and looking for this stuff actively, you're starting to see it. But it's hard for that kind of stuff to rise above what's being shoved in your face on by the record companies and by, you know, Spotify playlists and stuff. So, as you say, I don't think it's going to become the big thing, but we don't want it to anyway, because then everyone starts jumping on it and it just becomes ridiculous. But it would be nice if it would just find a little bit of a bigger audience. That would be wonderful, because there's some amazing talent out there doing stuff. And, you know, for me personally, every time I hear something like that, it just takes me back. And that's what I look for.
Have you got some sort of deal going? Was it Demon Music? Have you got any little deal?
Yeah, Crimson on the, yeah, it's part of the BBC. Yeah, they look after my catalogue for me. Yeah.
Okay. We've got Dan who said, would you ever do a Bobby Caldwell song one day? But on the other side, I also wanted to find out, would you ever do Colonel Abraham's Trap a version?
You know what? I would have to listen to Trap to see. You know what? I've recorded so many cover versions, not the ones that I've actually released. I've recorded other ones as well, but they don't always work for me, for my voice, my range, and just generally my style, even though I really want to do the song. And so I've always got a list of songs, cover songs that I want to do, just because I just want to pay homage to and pay tribute to these amazing songs, these amazing writers and stuff. I always consider people's suggestions. There's a song cover on I released called Just Another Dream, which is a song that no one has ever known about. It was something that a fan sent to me. They said, you should cover this song, Just Another Dream, and I'd never heard it. And when I played it, I was like, wow, that actually is really up my street. And so I just did my own version of it, but it was just for me. It's just on the end of one of my cover albums. But yeah, I always listen to people's suggestions of stuff that would work for me, which I enjoy. But as I say, I try to do them. They don't always work, so I shelve them because I have to feel that I can do something with it, that I can make it my version. Mm-hmm. Some people suggest songs that I think, no, that's too classic. If I touch that, it's just never going to be. Why would you listen to my version when you can listen to the original one?
Yeah, your version of Killers.
I would listen to my version. I would listen to the original one.
What about when would you see Smile Again, the Babyface track? Because if I'm listening to it, I can now see where you are. You're trying to, now that you mentioned Babyface, and I can see a track like that, how similar your vocals, your range is.
Which one was that by Babyface?
When will I see?
It was on the Velvet DeVoe album.
Yeah.
No. It's the one that he had.
The actual Babyface song.
Yeah. The one that he. When will I see you again?
When will my heart beat again?
Yeah. That's it.
That's a great, great, great song. Yeah. I mean, for example, something like that could really work. And sometimes I'll just listen to, because I have all my 80s playlists. Whenever I'm listening to music, I don't listen to anything modern. I only listen to old stuff. And sometimes they just crop up and I'm like, wow, that would be a fantastic one to try out. So I have a massive list of songs that I want to look into. But that one is a great one. Yeah. I mean, I remember when that came out, listening to it. That whole album was absolutely incredible.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I know we your fans are all over the place, and we've got you for a short time. But when you look back at the five favorite songwriters and producers, who would make, if you had an opportunity to have five, your top five, who would be in that top five?
So straight away, Benny and Bjorn from ABBA. We'll count them as one person.
Okay, that's ABBA. That
was the what basically was like got me into this is what I want to do. Then you got Jam and Lewis, of course, Rod Temperton.
Wow, yeah.
Diane Warren.
Okay.
Absolutely. And I love and there's also quite a few songwriters that you don't necessarily they keep a very low profile because obviously some of these songwriters that I mentioned are sort of producers as well, so you know them from production. But there's obviously songwriters that are sort of not very well known that I sometimes listen to. But those ones are the main ones that I would just, and you know, you've got the David Foster type people as well, who are just incredible producers. And
you did have a David Foster type track on your album. I'm trying to remember which one it was.
I think it was Hero in a Movie Scene, it was called.
Yeah,
it was my Pete Satira Chicago homage, because Chicago in the David Foster era were just, that was it for me as well. Amazing, those power ballads are just wow, you know.
Yeah,
there's somebody that says, oh, it's just schmaltzy and you know, too sweet and stuff, but I was just the big snare with the reverb on it and the loads of vocal reverb. I was so into that kind of stuff. It was incredible.
Yeah, no, I mean, but you think about the movies, then the music, how they went hand in hand, Ferris Bueller's Day Off and Breakfast Club and stuff like that. What about producers now? Because I know you've mentioned Jam and Lewis. I noticed you didn't mention Babyface in your top five, so...
I'm not mentioning him. I thought I mentioned Babyface. Okay. Babyface is in there. Yeah, sorry. Babyface is absolutely in there as a songwriter. Oh, my God.
Yeah, but do you have producers separately? Because I guess because you mentioned Diane Warren as a songwriter, and she's generally does her stuff with David Foster, but as a producer, because you're a producer as well as a songwriter. So production side, which five would you lean to as well?
There's an amazing producer called Humberto Gattaca. In the 80s did some incredible stuff. He did some of the Julio Iglesias stuff, and what's his Julio's other producer, Raymond somebody, I can't remember. And of course the Stockaken and the Waterman stuff that I mentioned earlier on. That stuff was just and they were sort of maligned a lot at the time because it was just like pumping out hit after hit after hit, and it was very not sound. It was, I don't think it was sounded like it was their style, just that Motown, you could say Motown was
LA and Babyface, they had a similar sound,
style. But you know, the Stockaken Waterman stuff, for example, it was just fantastic. It was really complex songwriting, so them as producers as well. And they say Teddy Riley and people like that, people that were innovating. As new synths were coming out and then audio started coming out and things like that. The people that really innovated in that kind of thing. But a lot of the stuff I always think of as well, it comes into my brain at the time and then later on I go, oh, I didn't mention that person. And I hate myself for it because it's just, I really wanted to say. So,
I mean, Stephen, I do.
Do you know this guy? Because I've been playing this guy quite recently. This French guy, De Buell.
Yes, because I'm good friends with De Buell. I have a song on his new album with him. We wrote together.
What, you got it on this album? This is his new album.
Yes, yeah, so on that. Well, that's the European release. On the Japanese release, it's coming to the main release again. He's going to do a deluxe version in a few months, and then I want to be on that one. But you can get it. It's on. You can find it on YouTube already. Someone's uploaded it a number of places. So I've done a few songs with him, and he's doing incredible stuff. Bring that Roger Troutman Zap cameo type sound back. really, really, really cool and superb quality. All the sounds are there, all the authenticity is there, and he obviously has
that. Does he speak English?
Yes, yes.
Because I'm going to say now, we need to get hold of this guy because I need to get connected to him.
Yeah, yeah. It's limited English. Limited English. We ask each other the way to the post office a lot, but we get there.
But speaking of Roger and Zap, did you ever? So during the 90s, we had because Steve and I do New Jack Swing podcast on Sundays. Did you ever get into any of that New Jack Swing? Or, you know, when it hit the UK.
I was absolutely bang into that. I loved Zap when I could hear them again. Because they weren't like what you call a popular radio. They were a little more niche. But I really did enjoy Zap. And I really went back to the Zap stuff when the Keith Sweat album came out. I can't remember what the name of it is now.
Would you put Your Loving Through the Test on? Was it that album?
Yes, that one. Yes, the get up on it album.
94, 95.
Yeah, and it had Loving to the Test was the song with Roger. And when I heard that, I was like, oh my god, I need to get back all of that stuff again. And I absolutely love all that stuff. Same as the Zap and the Cameo type thing with those like snares that sound like fly swatters, like. obviously Teddy Riley came out with those snares, and obviously on the Michael Jackson Dangerous album, those snares, the Cameo snares were all over it, and the Roger stuff. So I was absolutely hugely into that. It was hard to find it because, as I say, it was quite niche. Nowadays you can find it at a click of a button. It's easy.
Yeah.
At the time it was
Nandy, I've been trying to convince him to do a new Jack track for the last year or so. You did send me He sent me a snippet of something that was been remixed or worked on, but I guess it's going to remain unreleased now, I guess.
Yeah, I might have to.
I thought it was going to be on the new album, but I realised it probably wouldn't, with the concept, yeah, the sound, it wouldn't fit really. You know,
I might have to do a little side EP album of just a couple of new Jack remixes of a couple of my songs. it would be quite cool. Because
you released like a vinyl and a double CD late on last year. How did that do for you? That volume, was it to be continued? Volume one.
Continued. Yeah. So it was kind of a best of what I'd done up to that point. It was one of those things that I was keen to do because music is not physical anymore. Everything's it's all streaming, and I thought I would really love to hold something in my hand that, like I used to do, and have the sleeve and all that, and the liner notes, and the read about it. And so I spoke to the label, and they said, you know, we'll do like a limited run of like a kind of best of thing. And I didn't want to call it the best of LaFlex. I actually wanted to call it the worst of LaFlex, or call it the greatest shits or something. But in the end, we went, it's not because I hadn't finished what I was doing. It wasn't because the greatest hits is sometimes the end of a career type thing. So I continued. So it's the best up till this point, and then I'm going to do some more. But that was fantastic. We didn't get to do any cassettes, but we did CDs and vinyls. Yeah. And I had to.
Did you sell enough to convince you to do something else?
I think they sold all of them. Actually, you can only get them on eBay now, I think, as far as I'm aware. And I had to sign all of them. They sent, because each one's got an inlay card. And I was like days with this pen just signing. And the first few hundred, you're like getting really keen, and you're like writing messages on the cards. And by the time you get to like 3,000, you're just like. And there's like people with really nice messages saying thanks for buying this, I really appreciate it. And saying there's other else just got signature.
But you were considering cassettes. I mean, I don't even know where people can play cassettes now. I mean,
I need to buy an old car so I can have a cassette player.
There's a few Donna Summer album reissue CDs out there with LaFlex remixes on, Nandy.
Yes.
Donna Summer.
Wow.
And you can get them in HMV and all the high streets. He's got LaFlex remixes. See, he's not even mentioned that. He's not even touched on that.
Yeah. Well, I had the opportunity to do that because my label, Demon, also look after the Donna Summer catalogue. And so when they were reissuing some of it, I was luckily enough to sort of say, is it okay, you know, to have a little go at this? And the last one I did was Mystery of Love, which was absolutely fantastic. And it came out so well. It's been such a, it's like one of the most popular tracks on my Spotify. It went really well over with the Donna Summer's fans, particularly. It was really cool.
We've got to sell this album before we let you go. So just tell us how long did this album take to make? When did you start making it?
This album was about, I normally put out one album and one covers album every year, but I didn't do one last year because I was making this album. But I was getting a bit lazy and doing other things. But at the same time, I was enjoying it, and so I didn't quite want it to end. I would just keep redoing things, or maybe writing, I'll just write one more song. And because there comes a point, there's certain points in the process I enjoy, and other points which I really hate. I hate the singing part. I don't singing part. That's like, I always leave that as long as I can. I'm, oh God, I need to sing this now. Get that out of the way. And so once I get to the bits that I enjoy, which is like, you know, just when it's just playing around and you're just adding bits and thinking what else you can put in it, I love doing that. So I didn't want it to finish it and bounce it down, export it ready to be sent out. I was like, if I can just keep adding things and messing around for a bit longer, I'm enjoying what I'm doing. So it took a bit longer, but I knew it was going to be a good one. It's probably my favorite one that I've done. I knew doing it that I had some great songs, and I didn't really know which ones to use as singles, actually, because I could have put them all out as singles if it was up to me. But that's why the first release was a double single, like an A and B side. You used to get an A side and a B side on your record. You don't get that anymore. So that's why Behind Closed Doors came out at the same time as the Let Me Take You to Bed, because then it was like the B side, essentially, which I wanted to do.
So it's called Flex Education.
Yes.
It's available on all streaming services. Physical copies available.
Not yet, but you never know.
Oh, well, Lunchbox, what she just said is she just bought your CD on Amazon and arrived today.
It must be the To Be Continued one.
Okay. Okay. Yeah. Okay.
Sellers on Amazon.
Yes. Wow. Loads of people are saying, how did you get your name, LaFlex? And you mentioned it was just something you made up just to hold.
Yes, it was. I had a friend of mine who gave me the nickname Flex. It was just a bit of fun years and years ago. It was just, obviously, it was like an inside joke. And so I just thought I'll use that, but I'll stick Le in front of it to sound a bit French and interesting. I was listening to sort of, it wasn't Daft Punk, it was someone similar to that at the time. I was just messing around. I thought, oh, if it sounds quite cool in French, I'll stick Le. And then I Googled Le Flex and nothing came up. Because whenever you're trying to think of an act name for something, you Google it and you go, oh, someone's got that. Someone's got that website, or someone's got that name. And no one had LaFlex. I thought, okay, I'll stick with that. But I didn't know if I liked it. So I thought, I'll stick with that so I can at least put the music out, and then I'll change it when I think of something better. And then I didn't think of anything better. And then people started listening to it, and then I got stuck. Okay. But it's so funny, I get messages, people going, hi, Le. Here's my name. Hey, Le.
Hello. Oh goodness. Well, I mean, it's been great, and as I said, Stevie has been championing you for a very long time. And you can see, it's amazing just seeing people from Mexico and from Spain and from all over the world tuning in to really celebrate your music.
Yes, I appreciate it. I mean, it is great. I mean, there's people from Japan. When I do some of the live streams, I get people in Japan, from Australia. The people in Australia are getting up at 3 or 4 a.m. to watch me live stream. It's ridiculous. And then there's like Chile and Argentina, the other side of
Mexico. Yes, she's from Mexico.
You always do a New Year's live stream.
A New Year's live stream. Yeah, I've become religion
that every New Year's we get LaFlex on live stream.
It's only because I've got no friends and got nowhere to go, so I'll live stream and maybe someone will say hello to me. Being a bit lonely, I get some love from the fans on New Year's Eve. But
Well, whenever you do get that new Jack Swing stuff together, you know, as I said, it would be interesting for us to play on our show on a Sunday night and get our new Jack Swing fans comfortable, because there is also a resurgence of that. So, from Azerbaijan as well.
Wow.
Wow. You're in Azerbaijan. There you go.
Yes, and he said he I think he said he was in. He sent. He's in a video. A new video he sent in.
Ah, who is it? Let me have a quick look. Parviz, yes. Yes, Parviz. He's in the video. Yeah. Okay. <Mr. Parviz.
laughs> Well, good. Do you edit the videos yourself, or do you get?
Yeah. I do it myself. Yeah, I had to learn how to use Final Cut, so I edit all my videos myself. I just like to be creative. I've just got one of those creative minds, so it's just I'm always doing something creative. I just need to be doing creative things to satisfy myself. So the videos I find are a pain because I don't like setting up all the video stuff, the cameras and the lights and the group. If I use a green screen or whatever the case may be, all that stuff is a real faff. So sometimes I've done it with people helping me, like the Smooth Talk video. That was someone else came in and did that for me, which was amazing. But yeah, it's difficult to do all that on my own. So I sometimes in the middle of it have a strop, go, right, this is the last video I'm going to make. Never is. I mean, the worst one was I had a video for a song of mine called Move With Me, where there's miniature Leflexes all on a table, all playing part of each member of the band is me, miniature dressed in different things. And you would not believe how long it took to edit that because I had to make myself green screen everything, make myself miniature, then film the tables and then trying to edit. And I had an old computer and it was just like going, no, 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 no.
It just says no.
Like every time you do a slight move, it would just, the beach ball would come up and you'd have to have a cup of tea waiting for it to beach ball. Like weeks trying to edit, but it came out so, so well. But yeah, stuff like that. I'm just cursing, you know. Because I've always got to try and think. The problem is I've got to try and think of something interesting to do as a video, but it's got to be something simple enough that, you know, you've got no budget, basically. You can't just go out and just...
And get Hype Williams to come in with it.
Exactly. So you need to think, well, what can I do that's really cheap and simple, but is going to look cool and, you know, it's going to interest people. So it's always something. I struggle to think of something because I love those guys... their songs were never very good, but their videos got them viral with the OK Go or something they were called. And their video is on in the gym on those little running machines, and they're going side to side on the running machines. I don't know if you've ever seen that. They're
no, I'll look out for that.
Just great ideas for videos. So I love all that kind of stuff. But sometimes I just make lyric videos. It's just easier. Just have a lyric.
It's easier. Well, I was also referring to the fan videos. Do you edit those ones or do you get some?
I edit those, I edit those, yeah. So I said, when I realized I haven't got the second line of the verse because no one sent it to me, I'm like, oh, shit.
So, fans, make sure when you are doing the videos next time, make sure you're singing all the verses and not just the chorus.
Yeah, I mean, some people literally. We'll just sing one line. They'll just do a video and they'll do one line and send it in. I'm like, but there's 30 other people have sent that in. So you're not going to get included. You need to give me more to work with.
Yeah.
And then some people will do like a whole 3.5 minutes. They'll do the whole song and they'll do, and like, okay, that's brilliant.
And is that ideal? Yeah. So guys, next time when you're making, sending in the videos, make sing the whole song and then you definitely be sure to be in it.
It's all good. And it's great to see because there's young people and there's like kids.
Yeah, I saw one.
When there's kids, you know, pensioners, range of people, and there's a guy on Japan on his motorbike or something. It's like,
Oh man, I mean, we definitely appreciate the fact that you've come on. I know this is it's mainly an R&B channel, but actually the fact that you come from your music comes from an era that actually was very. You know, everyone was listening to it. So, you know, you were listening to Elton the same way you were listening to Wham, the same way you were listening to Stevie and Colonel A and those times. So that's one of the best parts of what you're doing now. Yeah. And definitely, hopefully we'll get you back when you got something.
Keeping a lot of us going, this guy, seriously, with what he's doing. You know, with real, you know, songs, grooves, you know, upbeat, up-tempo-ness. You know, it's been missing for a while, you know.
I appreciate that, Steve.
You know, there's a whole audience there that, you know, it's keeping us all going. So we do appreciate Leflex, you know.
Thank you so much.
I listened to earlier, Falling. I mean.
Falling, yeah.
Oh, you know, how catchy is that record? You know.
And in the video, I'm on a little child's bike in the video. Yeah. Yeah. Again, I was just like, what can I do for this video? I've got this 360 degree camera on a child's bike. I'm going to just pedal around on this and make it honestly. Things I do. Goodness.
It's one thing to start making your songs. Now you're doing your videos and stuff. So, but it shows the passion, and it's not just there's a passion to it.
I mean, that's what people, a lot of the fans are going, oh, I love your humor and stuff, you know, like say riding around on a kid's bike in the video and stuff. It's just like, I just have to do these things because it's just a laugh, and because, you know, I haven't got the budget for the thriller video or even just a normal music video.
Yeah.
So like, what can I do? Just something that will just make people smile. The music is very serious for me. I take that seriously, and the quality is there. I know that. But the videos, I mean, although the videos for the new album have tended to be, the quality's gone up a little bit. It's a bit better. But a lot of time it's just me with an iPhone just being an idiot and just having fun and, you know, sticking it together.
Where do you find these amazing models from in some of your videos as well?
That would be telling.
Oh, goodness.
My DMs mainly.
Well, don't forget that the fans will ask when we'd ever see you live. And is that something that you'd hope that you'd be able to put something live for them?
I would love to do that. I would love actually if people would band together and say, there's enough of us now. Come and play for us, or come and do a gig in my living room. We'll live stream it. I'll do that. That sounds like fun to me. So I think something like that would be quite funny, actually. Just go to a fan's living room and do a live gig and live stream it would be quite funny. Hey, but yeah, I would like to do that. Yeah.
Well, have a John, you know, Tokyo. Who knows?
A lot of that stuff. The problem with the live stuff is the logistics of it, because obviously you got the band together, you've got to sort out the traveling and the tour, and then you've got to practice. And I love to just sit in the studio and write songs and record songs. I can just do that day after day. But to actually I have a problem when I live stream, like the New Year's Eve, people will request songs and I can't remember them. I literally don't remember the songs that I've written. Once I've put it down and recorded it and it's gone out, I'm on to the next one.
Yeah.
And then I have to get the session up and work out what did I do, what were my chords and stuff. Sometimes some of the songs I remember, but a lot of the time I don't remember them, so I'd have to rehearse and relearn all my songs as if they were somebody else's. It's crazy. Lyrics and stuff I forget.
My goodness. Yeah, well, definitely. I mean, appreciate your time, Lufika. I know we kept you over.
No worries,
over,
my pleasure.
But Flex Education is out on all streaming services, and hopefully soon the actual physical copy will be available soon as well.
Absolutely. And so thank you for having me on. I really appreciate the support, Stevie. Keep listening. Thank you so much for all you do for me. I really appreciate it. And for the guys that are watching that have been messaging and stuff, thank you very much. Keep listening. I really do appreciate it. I'm very grateful to have you. And I get your messages and your comments, and it makes it worthwhile. It really does.
Yeah. All right. Well, thanks, guys. And yes, as Dan says, he's waiting to see you New Year's Eve.
I'll be there with my scotch and cigar.